The Ultra Music Festival has a new home, sort of, and not everybody's happy about it. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Miami-Dade County Commission decided that the three-day rave party known as Ultra will be on Virginia Key next year. Well, now there are angry residents, concerned scientists, and another festival organizer yelling unfair. We're going to learn more about the story. Also, amidst the election recount from last week, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission met. Surveillance footage from the shooting on February 14th now raises questions about the response of medics to the tragedy. And we're going to talk with the folks from Jackson Health Foundation. We're going to learn about new developments with the Pediatric Neurosurgery Center. And finally, our Basel's almost here, but did you know that Florida has actually been a favorite destination of world-renowned artists for centuries? A new exhibit in Boca Raton proves it. That's Sundial, coming up next. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, nearly 2 weeks after Election Day, and Florida has finally wrapped up its election results. Three statewide races were called into recount because of the thin margins between the candidates after a machine recount on Thursday of last week. Republican Ron DeSantis was declared the new governor-elect of Florida over Democratic challenger Andrew Gillum. In the Senate race, Democratic challenger Bill Nelson conceded defeat to Republican governor and now Senator-elect Rick Scott. And in the Agriculture Commissioner race, Democrat Nikki Fried benefited from the recount, defeating Republican Matt Caldwell in that recount by a little more than 6,000 votes. Now, the recounts have already had an impact on elections personnel. Embattled Supervisor of Elections in Broward County, Brenda Snipes, who faces lawsuits from Rick Scott and Matt Caldwell, submitted her resignation on Sunday just after finishing the recount. Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections Susan Booker continues to face scrutiny. Her county may be continuing its recount for weeks after missing the state's mandated deadline on Sunday. Now, we'll continue to keep you updated on all of this weekend's election news on our website, WLRN.org, and of course during our newscasts on All Things Considered and on Morning Edition. But meanwhile, amidst last week's election recount, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission met again and reviewed surveillance footage from the shooting on February 14th. WLRN education reporter reporter Jessica Bakeman has been covering the ongoing story for us, and she joins us now for an update. Jessica, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right. One of the key individuals that the commission, and by the way, this commission meets once a month, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the key individuals the commission wanted to investigate did not show up Thursday. Tell us again about Deputy Scott Peterson.
So Scott Peterson was the school resource officer assigned to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. He was a member of the Broward Sheriff's Office, and he resigned under pressure after it came out that he hid rather than going inside Building 12 where the shooting was taking place. Being that he is the school resource officer and assigned to the school, you know, he was the first law enforcement officer who could have gone into Building 12 during the shooting while it was happening, you know, potentially could have confronted confessed shooter Nicholas Cruz and, you know, some people argue may have been able to save some lives or stop the shooting, you know, while it was happening.
And there was another video that came out where they actually were showing us footage from the different cameras on the campus. And also they had an animated, I guess, display of where different people were at different times. And I watched the whole thing and you saw the little dot that represented Peterson. He was in one spot almost the entire time. Could Peterson face criminal charges if he doesn't show up for the next meeting?
So the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission has subpoena power, and the commission did subpoena Scott Peterson to testify, and he didn't show up. So what actually happened instead was his lawyer appeared and said that he was fighting the subpoena and that he was suing the commission. We've since seen that complaint. Basically, Scott Peterson and his attorney argue that the commission is trying to put together a criminal case against him, which it doesn't have the jurisdiction to do. And so he was trying to quash the subpoena. And the members of the commission were obviously not happy that he wasn't there. Several of them said they weren't surprised. They thought if he did show up, he might just plead the fifth and not actually talk. But they said that they were going to look into trying to hold him in contempt of court for defying the subpoena. And specifically, I spoke with State Senator Lauren Book, who's a Democrat who represents Broward County. And she said that she'll be in Tallahassee tomorrow, which is the organizational session, when basically now that the elections are finally over, the legislature will, you know, designate their leaders and kind of make a plan for the session going forward. And since she's going to be there and be able to talk to some of her colleagues in the legislature, she said she was going to find out if there was anything else they could do to get him to come and talk to them.
Peterson wasn't the only person or the only individual that didn't show up for the questioning. Why did the FBI face scrutiny for their actions?
So you, I'm sure you remember that the FBI got two different tips from people suggesting that Nicholas Cruz might shoot up a school, and essentially they didn't, you know, adequately follow up on those tips. And so the commission did want to interview the FBI as well, or a representative from the FBI, to find out what happened there. And what the chair of the commission, who is Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, said is that he's been asking them to come, and in maybe over the summer they said, well, we can't send someone because we're doing an internal investigation to try to find out what happened, and that we may be able to appear before the commission in the fall, like in September, October, to present their findings of, you know, that internal investigation. And what Bob Gualtieri said this week was that they have now gotten in touch with him and said, we're not going to send someone, but we're going to send a package of information telling the commission what they found in their investigation. And they said that they mailed it on the 9th of November, but Gualtieri said he didn't get it. So I called today to follow up and find out, you know, if they received it late Friday or today. I haven't heard back yet, but basically he's still waiting. He says he doesn't know what's in it, and, you know, he may be able to update the commission in the future. But there was an interesting comment from one of the other commission members who's the Polk County Sheriff, and he said, well, you know, if they had done everything well, they probably would be showing up here with a band, you know, like ready to celebrate their actions. But the fact that they didn't want to show up maybe tells you what you might find in that report.
There were questions about whether or not the surveillance footage was delayed. What are we talking about here? Is it a technical issue, or they just don't want to release that stuff?
So basically the question is about whether law enforcement should have the ability to monitor in real time the surveillance footage that is being taken inside of schools by their security footage, their security cameras. So what happened on February 14th was that the police were watching this footage and they believed that it was live. And so at one point they were inside building 12. They were trying to figure out what to do next. And what they saw on the videos was that confessed shooter Nicholas Cruz was moving from the third floor to the second floor. And so they thought they were still in an active shooter response, and they were like hesitating to move because they thought he was coming at them armed. And then they found out too late that this footage was delayed by 26 minutes. And so they were waiting to go upstairs because they thought he was still there, when actually he had already left campus. And because of that delay, they were not able to go up to the third floor to help 10 people who had been shot
and get the medics up there. They
exactly.
couldn't get the medics up there in time. Again, watching the footage, it was eerie to see a camera caught Nicholas Cruz running on the other side of campus. And
he actually ran by West Glades Middle School, which is next door. And that was one of the things that Senator Book brought up, which was that when the school district is considering like their code red policies, you know, they have to think about that too. Like, was West Glades under a code red? Like, she said they weren't. And, you know, she said it could have been worse. What if Nicholas Cruz left Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and then, you know, the police thought he was still there, but he's instead in West Glades next door.
Talking again with WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman, we're discussing last week's meeting of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. The panel led by Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri reviewed surveillance footage from the shooting on February 14th, is now determining whether further disciplinary charges are required. What are the Parkland parents saying about, I mean, everything that's come out so far, but, you know, law enforcement's response, medics' response, I mean, they've seen everything we now know, too.
Right. So there are a couple of parents of students who were killed on the commission itself, and then there are a couple of others who regularly attend the meetings and speak during the public forums. Obviously, they're angry. They want change. And, you know, in this case, at this point, you know, we have such detailed information. I mean, you watch the animation, but there was a PowerPoint presentation of more than 600 slides, and every single one was like, this is what happened 10 minutes and 44 seconds after the first shots were fired. This is what happened 12 minutes and 20 seconds, right? On and on and on. So the kind of detailed information they have now is what they're using to say, okay, here are the specific policy changes we need to make this not happen in the future. So for example, one of them is dealing with the surveillance footage. Max Schachter, who is on the commission, whose son Alex was killed, is saying we absolutely have to have the Broward County School Board give law enforcement access to live, real-time surveillance footage, but the school board is resisting. And the way that Gualtieri explains it is that different lawyers for school districts throughout the state disagree over whether allowing law enforcement, not just during an emergency, but literally anytime they would want to just say, oh, what's going on in this school right now? And they could key into the surveillance footage, that that would potentially be a violation of federal laws that protect student privacy.
And of course, the Broward County Superintendent, Robert Brunsey, he took a very sharp tone at the meeting. He's been under harsh scrutiny for his response to the shooting. Let's take a listen.
We are in our kind of 9/11 moment for public education. And we need to redefine what the education system looks like, what the priorities are. And I will tell you that as far as safety, mental health, no question that those areas are as important and maybe more critical than the academic piece, because we'll never get to any of that unless we get those two pieces right.
So he has his supporters, but there are people who are saying maybe he needs to be replaced. But what's going on in that conversation? How are people feeling about his, the way he's reacted to all this?
I think, first of all, I would say that he's pretty much out of the woods once we got past the school board elections that happened in August. Obviously, there were some people running who were saying they wanted to get rid of him and replace him. You know, one of those in particular was Ryan Petty, who's the father of Elena, who was killed, and he's also on this commission, and he didn't win his race. And so I think the school board remains a majority of the school board that supports him. Also, just seeing, you know, how the commission reacted to Runcie when he was speaking during his testimony, you know, he appeared to be apologetic. He was appeared to be very open-minded to the ideas that they were bringing up. And while they were frustrated that there are changes that they want to be made, that they say it's been 9 months, it's unacceptable that some of these changes haven't already been made, they, I think, feel that overall he is cooperating, and that's not necessarily the case for some of the other characters.
And along with the superintendent Runcie, Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel gave testimony as well during that meeting. How did Israel respond to questioning?
So that's what I was going to point out, is that there was just such a different attitude and sort of demeanor put forth by Robert Runcie and Scott Israel, who of course both are local leaders in Broward that took a lot of scrutiny and criticism for their handling of the event. So while you have Robert Runcie, who's being open and pledging to make changes, Scott Israel was instead mostly being defensive, and he was blaming pretty much everything that went wrong on Scott Peterson, when there were other BSO deputies who were hiding behind cars and behind trees. And as you went through the law enforcement response, it was very clear that the Coral Springs Police Department was much more aggressive in terms of going into the building and doing the response in a way that people were happier with than BSO. And basically, one of the specific issues that came up during that testimony was that the active assailant policy for BSO has the word may. It says that deputies may enter an active assailant situation, but it doesn't say that they must. And the commission is pushing for that change because they think that these BSO deputies didn't go in because the policy protected them, and saying that they didn't have to.
When's the final meeting expected? They're almost done, right? There's another one coming up?
There's a meeting in December, and they have to get a report to the legislature by January 1st. However, they did point out that the commission in state law has a 5-year life, and that they intend to continue to meet to, I guess, monitor the progress, although it's not clear if they're going to meet monthly going forward.
Do you imagine, I mean, they're going to, you know, bring their findings, but, you know, in that report, what do you think it's going to do for school safety policies? We have a law that went into place after the last legislature. What could they add to that?
So they actually did publish a draft PowerPoint presentation with some bullet points of recommendations that they might include in the report. And I think we'll hear about those in a lot of detail in December as they're finalizing it. But for a few examples, they want to clarify the law that was passed to say that whether you're the SRO or the armed guardian, that those people need to be on campus all day long, because some of school districts have what they call floaters or floating people who are like, maybe they spend part of a day at one school and then they spend the rest of the day at another school. So that's one change. Another change is that they would mandate what's called hard corners, which is making sure that there's a corner in the classroom that is out of the line of sight from the classroom window, where students could, there's not objects or desks or anything blocking it, so that students can get into that area and then they would not be able to be reached by a shooter.
And a shooter couldn't see them from looking through the door.
And apparently they said that there was at least one student who died like on the line of the hard corner because she couldn't get into the hard corner.
Again, talking with WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman. Again, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission met last week. And, you know, again, they are going to put together a report that they're going to send to the legislature about what they've learned from the shooting on February 14th to see if any other changes are going to come about. Jessica, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right. Still to come, the Ultra Music Festival has a temporary home, and there's plenty of anger about that choice. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Ultra Music Festival has plenty of fans and plenty of detractors, and now it has a new home. Well, sort of. Last week, the city of Miami decided to move the festival to Virginia Key, at least for 2019. Fans will be happy, but the residents of Virginia Key, not so much. And there are even scientists concerned that maybe the music could be harmful to some species. And there's an organizer of another festival who says this isn't fair. All right, so joining us now is Miami Herald's Joey Fletch. It's always a pleasure, Joey.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And by the way, I do have to correct, because I know that in the billboard I said Miami-Dade Commission. It's the city of Miami
right.
that made this vote. So I wanted to clarify that mistake. All right, so take us back to the meeting last week. This had been debated for some time. What stood out for you, you know, as to how they came to this decision and what was going on?
Well, this came on pretty quickly, and there was the overarching feeling from the residents of neighboring Key Biscayne that there was no prior notice to when this was put on the agenda. There was really only like 10 days or so of processing this proposal before it went to a vote for a licensing agreement that would basically place Ultra on Virginia Key.
Were there any other potential sites?
No, not that we know of. People have definitely, in kicking it around in social media, said, oh, why don't they go to Homestead? Why don't they go to, Hard Rock Stadium? But as far as the city's concerned, the only other spot that they were considering inside city limits was Virginia Key. So at the meeting, a host of people from Key Biscayne who worried about traffic were worried. They spoke at the public comment, and there were environmental activists saying this is a protected area. There's wildlife here that could be impacted by the noise. So there were a lot of concerns, a wide range of concerns brought up. But in the end, the commissioners really were focused about the money. That's what they talked about the most. They squeezed Ultra for another $600,000. So it's a flat fee of $2 million for at least 1 year. It's a licensing agreement that can be revoked a year ahead of time. So this is basically like you can consider 2019 from the perspective of some commissioners, at least, as a one-year trial.
Hasn't Virginia Key hosted festivals before?
You're right, they have.
Anything of this size, though?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't believe anybody comes close to the roughly 50,000 people per day that Ultra sees. There's Grassroots Festival, there's Rapture, which is the other electronic music festival that has now been sort of elbowed out by Ultra, and that's controversial for them and their attendees. But no, the Ultra would be the largest. They would be the biggest festival. And it's two. So it's interesting because it's also two areas. It's on the area right behind the Marine Stadium, and then inside Virginia Key Beach Park. And they would be connected by like a walking path.
Hmm.
And that's a very new, different situation for Ultra.
So let's look at some of the things that have gotten people upset. I mean, obviously one of them is traffic, but the other thing too is, I mean, it's not just the fact that there have been festivals, you know, out in Key Biscayne, but I mean, also they had the tennis tournament out there.
That's
so true. Aren't they used to having traffic anyway, or they just don't like it?
Well, they don't like it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could say they're used to it, perhaps, but you know, it's the same concern every time there's a major event, and if you think about it, you know, it does make sense to have some consideration for one way off the island, one way on. If there's an emergency, if there's, you know, a reason that, you know, they need to get off the island, you know, the traffic could create a problem. But Ultra maintains that they are going to have a plan to keep lanes free, to shuttle people. So one of the interesting changes here, not necessarily change, but it's a new dynamic, because in downtown you can get where at Bayfront Park, which is where Ultra was before, you can get there a number of different ways. You can take the Metro Mover, rideshare easily. There's roads on Virginia Key. There's going to be no parking for anybody who attends the festival, and so it's all going to be a system of apparently shuttles, water taxis, ride sharing.
Do they park on this side and then they get across?
Yeah, somewhere. We don't know where. They don't have to turn in a traffic plan until closer till.
And the organizers are taking responsibility for that.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's people look at that and they say, how are you going to pull this off? And everybody's wondering that, honestly. It's a new thing for them to shepherd all these people onto the island.
And again, we're talking about the future of the Ultra Music Festival with Miami Herald's Joey Fletches. You know, if you're a fan of the festival, do you care where they hold it? And if you live, you know, anywhere near where it's coming, if you live anywhere near, you know, in Virginia, Key Biscayne, how do you feel about this? And I'm also curious, is there a community that would want to host this? Find us on Facebook. Go to Sundial, WLRN Sundial on Facebook. And we posted up something there. We asked the question. Somebody actually did respond and said, hey, how about Key West? Okay, we can ask the folks in Key West. Do they want to host Ultra? But we'd love to hear your thoughts about this. Wildlife. Scientists, you said researchers, were worried about what Ultra could mean for some wildlife mm-hmm. in the area. What exactly are we talking about?
So there was a letter submitted to the commission that day that was signed by the dean of Rosenstiel School at the University of Miami. And he was saying that they have a research facility right there on Virginia Key. And research shows that noise at a high decibel level can actually hurt the fish, can hurt marine life and also birds. And it can cause them to, in some cases, when the sound is loud enough, it's near enough. If you have a research, like a tank full of fish that you're using for research, if they're disturbed enough, if it's loud enough, they might attempt to jump out of the tank. They might actually try to escape the tank and then end up hurting themselves and killing themselves by banging their heads on the wall, on the glass. So, and you know, that might create what for some people is a tough, disturbing image. Like, wow, how could anyone let this happen? There's a lot of questions to be answered there, though, right? Like, how loud is it going to be in that facility, with and where are they going to put the stages and face the speakers and all of that sort of stuff, which we don't know, by the way. We don't know the site plan yet, but it raises concerns.
And one of the other things too I'd read in your story was that there was worry that you have to create barriers to keep people out of certain areas,
right?
Out of sensitive areas. And I'm just thinking, what is that, fences? What are they doing?
Well, they've used in the past to keep people from like toppling the fence and breaking in. That happened 1 year where a security guard was actually trampled when folks broke into the festival because they didn't have tickets. They've used like racetrack grade fencing to keep people out, and that's been successful. And what they were saying on Thursday is they would replicate that. They would use that to line a path so that no one wanders off into, you know, nature, you know, a natural area that is protected, or for that matter, from wandering, you know, into water and hurting themselves. So that also raises, how are you going to execute that effectively? How are you going to make sure that, you know, every single spot is covered? And is that even good? Can, you know, does that hurt the environment to do that?
And to remind people, the festival's when? In March, right?
It's in March, March 29th through 31st.
So, I mean, you know, they knew Bayfront, so they had their strategy. Now it's a whole new area, and they've got to think of a new strategy. Is there a deadline as to when they're supposed to come up with this plan for traffic, barriers, and everything else?
Yeah, 2 months before the festival itself, they're supposed to reveal their traffic plan and their environmental management plan. They have pledged as part of this licensing agreement to hire an environmental consultant to work with them on this plan, and if the city administrators aren't happy with that plan, Ultra's responsible for hiring a second environmental consultant to bolster it.
Real briefly, the Rapture Electronic Music Festival, what was that one?
It was another electronic music festival with a bit of an older crowd and a much smaller crowd, a neighborhood of 6,000-7,000 people this year, that had they had staged their previous festivals on Virginia Key. They had a verbal commitment in the form of a letter from an agency that runs the programming on the island that they could come back. They had paid. They had submitted a deposit to use the space. My understanding is that deposit had not been cashed and it was at the city. And some of this actually happened and came together rather quickly as the Ultra news came out. And at the end of the day, the commission instructed the city to say, well, you need to find another place for these folks. Like, we want to accommodate them, but just not in Virginia Key because we're putting Ultra there. And, of course, that very much upset the owners of Rapture. And, you know, they told me on Thursday they're considering their legal options, but they're also very upset and are trying to, you know, obviously show people that, you know, they were there first and they deserve more respect than that.
Why didn't the folks in the community have a stronger say in whether or not they wanted this?
It was a situation where the city of Miami limits are, like, Virginia Key is within the city limits of the city of Miami, right? Key Biscayne is its own local government, its own municipality. And it's sort of an old argument. It's happened with the boat show. Like, you know, okay, fine. You have jurisdiction. You can call the shot on your land. But this impacts us. We share that causeway in terms of access. So why aren't we more part of the conversation? And it cropped up again. I mean, with this coming out, I mean, a lot of folks in Key Biscayne said they found out about this Ultra proposal when we published a story in the Miami Herald. And that doesn't sit well with – when public officials say that, they usually don't like that. They don't like finding out about things that might impact them in the newspaper. They'd rather get briefed on it beforehand. So there was a lot of tension between the governments. That was tangible on Thursday. They also had a meeting and talked about it. And the officials I talked to afterward from Key Biscayne said they felt like they were more comfortable with the city's inclusion going forward. They're going to be at the table is what they were told. So like when this environmental review plan and traffic plan is unveiled, the expectation is that Key Biscayne folks are going to be looking at it too and reviewing and scrutinizing.
And festival attendees, if they've already, I don't know, can you buy your tickets already? They already bought
tickets. Oh, they've been on sale. Right. I mean, okay. One of the biggest questions that when they got kicked out of Bayfront Park was like, well, where are you going to do it? Because people have already started to buy tickets and make travel plans.
This is just for 1 year that we know of, right?
Minimum. Yeah.
Has anybody mentioned after that?
No. Well, I mean, only in the context that the city officials were saying if it doesn't work, we will revoke that agreement. Like, we have the right to, and if there are any problems, snafus, we'll cancel it. And then Ultra will just have to figure something else out.
No, because the other thing is that for those people who've already bought tickets, I mean, yeah, it's a new location, so what's changed for those folks?
Well, and there was a point made during the conversation on Thursday from the festival organizers that they're, you know, they have to account for a change in attendance because people might not, even people who bought tickets, like, who knows if they're going to be really interested in going to this location. I mean, I know, and it's totally unscientific, but at least in social media, people were tweeting at me saying like, oh, well, I mean, I'm not going to do it if it's not at Bayfront. I'm not going to go. And remember, Ultra has a huge international attendance. So there's people who make very, way ahead of time, they make expensive long-term or long-range travel plans. And so some folks are saying, look, if you're not going to do it downtown, like, I'm just not into it. We'll see.
We shall see. That's true. All right. The Ultra Music Festival, again, it is being moved. It's at least for a year, coming up in March of 2019. It's going to be at Virginia Key. We'll see how that works out. We've been talking with the Miami Herald's Joey Fletches. Joey, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
And again, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear your thoughts. What community in South Florida would want to host it? And would you go if it was there? All right, still to come, we're going to hear from the Jackson Health Foundation about the future of pediatric care in the region. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the Jackson Health Foundation is undergoing a massive multi-billion-dollar renovation of its facilities. They are also in the midst of building a new 100-bed hospital in Doral. Now, although they receive a portion of public financing for new construction, they still need to raise millions of dollars privately for new projects. Tomorrow marks the 20th anniversary of the Guardians of the Children Luncheon. They're hoping to raise money for the neurosurgery program at Holtz Children's Hospital, part of Jackson Health Foundation. We spoke with Keith Tribble, president of JHF, about the fundraising challenges facing the healthcare system, the open enrollment, and the future of healthcare technology.
Fortunately, we are in a $1.6 billion renovation and construction. And when you hear that number, for people go, wow, that's a huge number. It is a huge number. It is the largest construction and remodeling in the country. I can't recall anyone who is undertaking that at the same time. When you see the new facilities, when you see the renovation, it'll be something that the citizens of South Florida will be very proud of. The biggest and probably the best new hospital we're building is the Rehab Hospital, which is going to be there located on main campus. It will be one of the four finest facilities in the country. And that's what we deserve here. We deserve the best. We are also building a medical center at Jackson West, it's called, out in Doral.
And that's the 100-bed facility, right?
That's exactly right, in Doral. It will be a hospital in that area, in that western area. And as you know, it's one of the fastest growing areas in South Florida. So we'll be able to service those citizens in that area. It will also have a children's ambulatory pavilion, which is sort of an outpatient. So the services that Jackson will provide in the next 5 to 10 years will be more expansive, cover in most of the entire county, from the hospital, the new one in Jackson West, to refurbishing Memorial and the new rehab hospital. We have Jackson North, Jackson South, and as of, I think as of today, we have about 5 to 7 new urgent care centers that are going throughout South Florida. So the ability to take health care to the community and be able to bring those individuals who have to have, more extensive service here on the main campus is going to provide very much quality health care for all of them.
And you're talking about the Doral facility. So that's been approved. Is there a timeline on that?
It should be ready in 2020, hopefully earlier. But as you know, with construction projects, you say it may be ready and things happen. But the timetable is around 2020.
I'm talking with Keith Tribble, president and CEO of the Jackson Health Foundation, Jackson Memorial Hospital, celebrating its 100-year anniversary in 2018. And has a special luncheon this on Tuesday, November 20th, to raise money for the Holtz Children Hospital. I hope I can also ask you about this, too, because we're in the process of open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act. Enrollment numbers are down by 4% from last year, as they were some concerns about the ACA's health under the Trump administration. But how is Jackson responding to concerns over the ability of people getting health care coverage?
Well, you know, that's always a problem. As I said, Jackson is a safety net. Yes, we would like for everyone to be covered, and we feel that that's an important thing for not only this community but for the nation. We struggle, or again, my counterparts, those in the hospital system, they struggle every year to try to make sure that they get the proper reimbursements, the proper things that are necessary for people who may not have insurance. That will be a constant struggle no matter what happens. But I would assume, and the more we can get people who have some kind of health care, whether it be the Affordable Health Care Act or, you know, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, I think it will bode well for the system if that happened.
So you talked a little bit about a while ago about, you know, the expansion, all these different projects going on. Where do you see Jackson's priorities as a hospital system in the coming decade?
A lot of people look at Jackson and say, well, that's a place where, you know, poor people go to get hospital service. It's a place where everyone comes to get service, whether you're poor or rich or in between. It doesn't make any difference. As I said earlier, the doctors don't know where you're coming from. All they know is that they're trained to provide the best medical health care. And I think our challenge, and the challenge that we will always have, is to make sure we have the necessary resources to have the finest and the best, not only in equipment, but in doctors or in the facilities.
And what do you think about, I mean, you think about the changes that are coming, not just in the patient's needs, but also in technology. And I'm just curious, you know, we've talked about on this program telemedicine.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you think that's going to change the way that you provide services to this community?
Well, I think it definitely will change. There's no question that, you know, you look at where medicine or anything of innovation has gone from 10, 15, 5 years ago. And the thing we have to do is we recognize that, and where our competitors or other hospitals may be deep into telemedicine, we can't put our head in the sand and say, well, we can't afford this, we can't do this, or whatever. We have to be able to provide that, because that's what the citizens of this county would want us to have. And so we are into telemedicine and all those things that are going to change the way medicine and how we treat the patient. And it's exciting. I've seen some examples of it, and it's a little scary, but, you know, it's something that's coming.
So you say it's exciting, it's a little scary.
It's a little scary.
What's scary?
Well, it's scary because now you've got this monitor and you've got the doctors not there sometimes. And, you know, we're so used to the doctor being there holding our hands and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have to be able to adapt to whatever the changes are. But you got to be sure and you got to be right. And it has to be something that can provide the comfort to the patient, which is very important. The comfort to the patient and how the patient feels and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And doctors have done that for so many years.
Let me finish up on this is, you know, when you talk about trying to get that support from the community.
Yes.
The economy's been really good, strong. How does it work with the health system if the economy starts going the other direction? Is that a concern for you, or there's always going to be support?
We just have to continue doing our job of getting out there and promoting and making sure people understand that at the end of the day, the system needs the support, not only the support that you've done in terms of your taxes, but also the philanthropic support, because you can't keep having the most modern equipment and the most sophisticated procedures and all that what you expect to have unless there's some funding.
That was Keith Tribble, president and CEO of the Jackson Healthcare Foundation. You can find more information about tomorrow's Guardians of the Children luncheon by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, long before there was Art Basel, artists came from around the world to the Sunshine State. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, we're just a few weeks away before we mark the beginning of Art Basel, the massive arts and culture celebration that brings tens of thousands of spectators to Miami Beach. The event continues to grow in popularity with 82,000 in attendance last year, and also, of course, showcases some of the premier artists from around the world. Now, long before there was an Art Basel, though, dating back hundreds of years, artists have flocked to Florida to capture the state's wildlife, the natural landscape, and the truly unique residents, because they've been around for a long time. That's the premise behind the new exhibition opening at the Boca Museum of Art next week, titled Imagining Florida, History and Myth in the Sunshine State. Now, the exhibition was 3 years in the making, and it includes more than 200 photographs, drawings, and paintings in the collection. We talked with Irvin Lippman, the executive director of the Boca Museum of Art, who took 3 years to put this exhibit together.
What I thought was important is to show that there's a continuum that goes back to the 1700s, where artists had been coming to Florida for a variety of reasons. The nature, you know, enthusiast, the explorer artist in the late 1700s, Audubon, who comes to depict the birds in the early 1800s, George Catlin, who comes to paint the Seminoles, and beautiful work in the exhibition of Savannah, pristine, that George Catlin has depicted with the woods all around. And of course, a few decades later, the woods are gone. So there's a romantic look at Florida from the early 1800s through the mid 19th century. So what I thought was important is to look at that visual history that goes back over two centuries. And it's time for us to see that continuum that leads us to the contemporary art today.
This exhibition was 3 years in the works, right?
Correct.
And I mean, you have pieces from places like the Smithsonian. What was the process of securing some of this work?
Well, the first step, I have to give credit to our two guest curators, Jennifer Harden, who is an independent curator from St. Petersburg, and then Gary Monroe, who many people in Miami will know. He's a photographer, teaches photography, and is all about Florida. And he did the photography section of the exhibition. So they ferreted out from institutions across the country, from the Metropolitan, from the National Gallery, from Crystal Bridges in Arkansas, and from private collections here in Florida.
Was there one piece that was really hard to get, or was there one piece you couldn't get but you wish you had?
Well, that's a good question. The one piece that I have to say I keep coming back to is a wonderful painting from 1938 by Ralston Crawford, a modernist work that shows the road from Tampa to St. Petersburg, sort of a one-point perspective. It's the most gorgeous painting that hasn't been seen for decades. It had been bought by Joe Hirshhorn in 1963 and then given to the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C. So we paid to have it cleaned since it had been out of view for such a long time. And that, I have to say, your eye cannot leave that. But what's so beautiful in this exhibition, certainly the painting section, is that you can, walking around the room, go from the 1880s and George DeForest Brush and the works of Catlin through the 19th, early 20th century and works like Ralston Crawford and Milton Avery. The painting exhibition stops in 1952 with Milton Avery. The photography section stops in 1969 with a wonderful photograph by Gary Winogrand taken at the Apollo launch in 1969 at Cape Kennedy. And we felt at that point it was, you know, Florida changes. It becomes a more international destination. Artists are coming here like Rauschenberg and Rosenquist, but they were less focused on the beauty, the nature, the fauna, the flora of Florida.
I wanted to ask you about the painting by John Singer Sargent. This one's Via Vizcaya.
Yes.
Striking painting. Describe it briefly for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Right. So you have a sailor in the foreground, and then Vizcaya, the dock, is right behind him. Beautiful watercolor that's on loan from the Orlando Museum of Art. And it's a wonderful scene of Vizcaya. By John Singer Sargent, who is probably the most famous American artist of the mid-19th century, or rather the early 20th century. Here was an artist who was well-known in Europe, in the Northeast, and he comes only once to Florida, and that's in 1917 at the invitation of James Deering, who, of course, had built Vizcaya here.
Were they friends?
They were friends. Of course, Deering invited all sorts of personalities to Florida and movie stars and artists. But that was his one visit here, and it's a remarkable watercolor.
You shared with us this book that contains all the artwork from the exhibition. On the cover is this photograph of a family visiting Sarasota Beach. It's all, you know, they're in all black attire with their car parked on the beach, Ohio license plate. Describe the photo for us and why it's indicative of the rest of the exhibition.
Yeah. Well, what's important about that license plate is that it says Ohio 1940. And so the people who are sitting on the beach are wearing their heavy overcoats. This is a winter scene on the beach. But it helps define the whole concept of imagining Florida. Here are people who are coming on their winter vacation from Ohio, not surprising. They're the ones who developed Naples and much of the west coast of the state. And they're sitting down having their picnic. They're imagining Florida. And I think this Marion Post Wolcott obviously is a favorite of ours because we put it on the cover of the catalog. But it's one of many works that I think visitors will find very engaging as they look at what is our visual history.
I'm speaking with Irvin Lippman, Executive Director of the Boca Museum of Art. The museum opens the exhibition Imagining Florida, History and Myth in the Sunshine State. The exhibition makes the case that long before there was an Art Basel, Florida has attracted some of the premier painters, photographers, and visual artists from all over the world. The exhibition also dives into some of the state's troubled history. This is fascinating. Tell us about the photographs of the construction of the Tamiami Trail.
Yes. Well, there's photographs, but I think most remarkable is a painting that was done during the Work Progress Administration. It was actually intended as a mural. It's on loan from the Smithsonian. I really doubt that it's ever been on public view, but it shows prisoners wearing their black and white shorts who are pulling high explosives building the Tamiami Trail. It's a remarkable painting. So yes, the myth and history of Florida is not always about the picturesque. It's also about the reality of how the state was made. There is a trail of tears in building that Tamiami Trail that led to the more romantic parts of Florida we'd like to think about.
Another fascinating one, too. This is a photograph taken by sociologist Lewis Hine. Mm-hmm. This one captures three young boys in a cigar factory, one with a cigar in his mouth. They each have solemn faces. Hines was interested in using his art as a tool for social reform. Why was it important for you to include these parts of Florida's history in the exhibition?
Yeah, well, it is part of our history. And just as we have quite a few works from the former administration, Farm Security Administration, that depict Florida during the Depression, depicts folks who were sort of down and out. The wonderful Berenice Abbott photograph that we have of folks gathering around a fruit stand under a banyan tree is one of the few works that Berenice Abbott, the great photographer of New York skyscrapers, depicts here in Florida. I think it's a good overview. At the same time, there's some crazy images, some great photographs by artists like Bruce Mozart, who many of the visitors will not have seen before, that he took in the underwater, the aquarium at Silver Springs, where models were hired to do daily tasks like cooking a fish or mowing the lawn, but underwater. How they did this, holding their breath and smiling simultaneously, I have no idea.
I mean, some of it's fun. Some of it, of course, catches the picturesque. Any of it supposed to be political, though?
Everything's political. I mean, the whole exploration of Florida, it's this amazing peninsula. You have Flagler, who's bringing artists down to show how wonderful the state is. Obviously, the state has changed greatly, and the exhibition reveals that.
Something else that's interesting, too, is that a lot of these artists are not from Florida. So they come down and now they are, through their work, trying to, create this picture, this representation of what they see. I'm curious, I mean, your thoughts on what you've seen. Did they get it right? Do you think that they, again, outsiders coming in, did they get the image right of what Florida is?
They got what sometimes the buyer wanted. Think of the highwaymen who are also in our exhibition, Alfred Hare and Harold Newton. They had a formula for painting the picturesque Florida in the 1950s. It's what people wanted. They bartered these works in the appliance stores and doctor's offices. They're remarkably beautiful paintings, but they don't show mosquitoes. They don't show the snakes. They don't show the alligators. It shows the landscape that we wanted. That's why the exhibition is called The Myth and History of the Sunshine State.
You have some fun stuff in here, too, because you've got a collection of souvenirs, alligator lamps, attraction brochures, ashtrays. Do you have a personal favorite, by the way?
I do have. I think the alligator lamp, minus the bulb, is still is a winner. And again, we have to thank Gary Monroe, who wrote the book Weird Florida. And I have to say this, the material culture part, which is really about outsider artists and folk artists, is the coda to the exhibition. It smacks a little bit of a garage sale, but it's very fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's got that garage sale tacky sense to it. But then again, that's part of Florida, right?
It's definitely part of our state.
That's Irvin Littman, Executive Director of the Boca Museum of Art, discussing Imagining Florida. You can see pictures of some of the artwork included in the exhibition on our Facebook and Twitter pages at WLRN Sundial. The exhibition is open, and it's going to be open through March 24th. Well, that's the program for today, this Monday, November 19th. Thank you so much for joining us. Find anything you want about Sundial on WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great Monday. Talk to you again on Wednesday.